Ekatra Podcast Conversations for the Curious Essential Knowledge Simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Ekatra AI. Welcome, curious minds. Today, we are undertaking a pretty massive deep dive. We're talking billions of years, trillions of miles.
Yeah.
Space.
Yeah, it's huge. We're leaving Earth behind, but not with sci-fi stuff. This is all hard science.
Exactly. We're diving into astrobiology, specifically through the work of David C. Catlin.
It's such a profound subject, isn't it? And our goal today really is to tackle that massive question. Are we alone?
Right.
But Catling's work really reframes that. He basically insists we stop thinking of life as this, you know, one-off fluke just for Earth.
Mm-hmm.
Instead, we need to see it as a rigorous cosmic process, something tied fundamentally to physics, chemistry, planetary evolution, the whole shebang.
I think that framing a cosmic process, mm-hmm. that's kind of revolutionary, isn't it? It shifts things away from just random luck to something more,
mm-hmm.
maybe inevitable, if the conditions are right. And this whole conversation, it feels incredibly relevant right now. I mean, we're not just talking theory anymore, are we?
Not at all. With things like the James Webb Space Telescope.
Right.
Wow. We actually have the tools now.
Yeah.
We can turn this ancient philosophical question into a real, like, evidence-based scientific hunt. We might actually be on the verge of knowing something.
Okay, so to really get this perspective, let's talk about the person guiding us. David C. Catlin.
Mm-hmm.
Who is he?
Well, he's a highly distinguished professor, Earth and Space Sciences at the University of Washington. And crucially, he directs the Virtual Planetary Laboratory.
That's a NASA-funded center, right?
Yeah, a big one.
Yeah.
It's all about figuring out which exoplanets might actually be habitable. He's right at the forefront.
What really stands out to me about him, though, is how he bridges these different fields. It's such a multidisciplinary area.
Totally.
He's not just looking at stars or just microbes. It's the interaction, isn't it? He links the planetary science, the astro part, with the life sciences, the biology.
Exactly. He's a real systems thinker. He gets that you just can't separate life's evolution from the planet it lives on. They shape each other.
Makes sense.
And his research really backs this up. He spent, you know, decades modeling how atmospheres evolve, early Earth, Mars, Venus, mapping out how life and the environment change together.
Wow.
And all that work feeds directly into the really exciting stuff now.
Wow.
How do we actually spot life signs, biosignatures from light years away using spectroscopy? He's basically drawing the map for where we go next.
Okay, so let's nail down the core argument here. The central thesis of Catlin's synthesis. It's this idea that life isn't just incidental.
Right. It's a cosmic process, deeply linked to the universe's basic laws, physics, chemistry.
Yep.
Almost inevitable, maybe, if you get the right conditions that last long enough.
And the scope he covers to argue this is,
yeah,
well, it's vast.
Oh, completely. Yeah. He starts huge with stellar nucleosynthesis, you know, how stars actually forge elements like carbon and oxygen, the building blocks.
Like the Stardust again.
Yeah. Then he zooms right down to the molecular scale, tackling abiogenesis, how life might have started from non-life, which is still a massive mystery.
The big one.
And then he brings us right up to today, detailing the strategies we're actually using right now to search.
And underlying all of this is a simple but pretty powerful idea. Earth is our template.
It has to be, doesn't it? It's our only example of life.
So Earth's 4 billion year history.
Mm.
That's our starting point.
Yeah.
We figure out how it worked here, then we look outward.
Exactly. Understand the template, then extrapolate.
Okay, let's start that journey where he does, with the cosmic setup, the prerequisites. He talks about stardust, not just poetically, but literally.
Yeah, the heavy elements we need for life, carbon, oxygen, nitrogen, all that stuff, they were actually cooked up inside earlier stars.
And then scattered by supernovae.
Scattered across the galaxy, exactly. So the immediate point is the basic chemical ingredients for life, they're everywhere. Ubiquitous, scientifically speaking.
Okay, so the ingredients are common. Check. But then things get more specific, right?
Yeah.
We always hear about the habitable zone or the Goldilocks zone.
Ah, yes. The Goldilocks zone, where water could theoretically be liquid.
Sounds a bit like finding the right neighborhood.
It does. But Catlin is quick to point out that's a huge oversimplification. Real habitability is way more complicated.
Okay. How so?
Well, you need more than just the right temperature. You need an atmosphere, probably, to trap heat. You need geological activity, like plate tectonics, maybe, to regulate things like carbon dioxide over billions of years.
Keeps the climate stable-ish?
Exactly. Maybe even a magnetic field to shield the surface from nasty radiation from the star. It's about a long-term stable balance, not just location, location, location.
Right, that makes sense. A whole system working together. Which brings us to maybe the hardest part, defining life itself. If we're looking for it, we need to know what it is. How does Catling define life for this search?
Yeah, it's tricky. He uses a working definition focused on what life does, not necessarily what it's made of. It's something like a self-sustaining chemical system capable of undergoing Darwinian evolution.
Interesting. So no mention of DNA or cells or even water specifically.
Nope. The key things are metabolism, some chemical process that keeps itself going, and natural selection. It has to be able to adapt, replicate, evolve.
And that definition leads right into the deep end.
Yeah.
Biogenesis. How do you get from simple chemistry to that? To self-replicating, evolving systems?
That's the billion-dollar question, isn't it? Catling goes through the main hypotheses pretty rigorously. One of the leading ideas is the RNA world.
Where RNA came before DNA.
Right. Because RNA can kind of do both jobs, store information and act like an enzyme to catalyze reactions. So it's a plausible stepping stone.
Hello.
He also talks a lot about deep sea hydrothermal vents, you know, those smokers on the ocean floor.
Yeah.
The chemical gradients, the energy available there. It's thought that could have provided the sort of power source needed to get the first metabolism going. We don't have the answer, but we have pathways that are scientifically plausible, testable even.
It's just amazing that the ingredients are so common. The pathways seem plausible, but then what happens when it actually takes hold on a planet? Let's use Earth as the template, life as a force.
Yeah, this is where that coevolution idea really comes alive. Life wasn't just hanging out on Earth, it was actively changing it, terraforming it.
And the prime example, the really dramatic one, is the Great Oxidation Event. About, what, 2.4 billion years ago?
That's the one. Basically, these early microbes, cyanobacteria, figured out photosynthesis and started pumping out oxygen. Just tons of it.
Wow.
As waste.
And Catling has that famous line calling it the greatest pollution event in Earth's history.
It really was. Oxygen was poison to most life back then. It probably caused a massive extinction.
Wow. A global catastrophe caused by life itself.
Exactly. But here's the twist. That catastrophe, that pollution, is what paved the way for us, for all complex oxygen-breathing life.
So life nearly wiped itself out, but in doing so, it re-engineered the planet for a whole new kind of life.
Precisely. It shows that life can fundamentally remake a world. That's the key lesson we take when we look elsewhere.
Okay, so that's the principle. Life leaves a mark.
Mm-hmm.
Where are we looking right now in our own solar system?
Yeah.
Following that idea, we always hear, follow the water.
Yep. And within the solar system, Mars is the obvious historical target. We know it used to be wetter and warmer.
Rovers are digging around there now, right?
Yeah, Perseverance and others are looking for signs of ancient microbes in the rocks, biosignatures from billions of years ago.
But maybe the more exciting places now are further out, the icy moons.
Oh, absolutely. Places like Europa, around Jupiter, and especially Enceladus, around Saturn.
Europa has that huge ocean under the ice, doesn't it?
Believed to, yeah. A global saltwater ocean kept liquid not by the sun, but by tidal heating. Jupiter's gravity basically needs the moon's interior, generating heat.
That tidal heating idea is so cool. It totally expands where you might find liquid water way beyond the traditional Goldilocks zone.
It really does. And Enceladus, well, Enceladus is maybe even more mind-blowing. The Cassini spacecraft actually flew through plumes, like geysers, erupting from cracks in its ice shell.
It flew through them.
Right through them. And guess what it found? Water vapor, complex organic molecules, salts. Basically, all the key ingredients for life as we know it.
Whoa. So we got a sample of a potentially habitable environment just sprayed out into space.
Yeah.
Without even landing.
Exactly. A free sample of its subsurface ocean. It's incredible data. It really hammers home Catling's point that life could be hiding in places we never expected, far from the sun's warmth.
Okay, so Mars, icy moons. But the really big frontier is looking beyond our solar system, isn't it? Exoplanets. How on Earth do we detect life, maybe just microbes, on a planet light years away that we can barely even see?
It sounds like science fiction, but it's happening. The main method involves using incredibly powerful telescopes like James Webb.
QWC, yeah.
To analyze the light from a star after it passes through an exoplanet's atmosphere.
So the atmosphere leaves a sort of fingerprint on the starlight.
Exactly. Different gases absorb different wavelengths of light. So you look for the chemical signatures of gases in that atmosphere.
But just finding gas isn't enough, right? Venus has an atmosphere.
Right. You're looking for something specific. The gold standard is chemical disequilibrium.
Disequilibrium, meaning things that shouldn't really exist together.
Pretty much. A chemical state that shouldn't persist naturally because the components react with each other or break down quickly. If you see it, something powerful must be constantly producing those components to keep the imbalance going.
Can you give us like a quick analogy for that?
Okay. Imagine walking into a totally sealed room. Inside, there's a lit candle right next to a big block of ice.
Okay, that seems unstable.
Exactly. Physics, entropy, says the candle should burn out, the ice should melt, everything should reach a boring equilibrium. If you find them coexisting like that, something must be actively working against nature, constantly relighting the candle and replacing the ice.
Got it. So that imbalance points to an active process.
Yes. And in astrobiology, the ultimate biosignature, the big prize, would be finding oxygen and methane in the same atmosphere simultaneously.
Why those two?
Because oxygen is usually linked to massive amounts of photosynthesis, like on Earth, and methane is often produced by microbial life. But crucially, these two gases destroy each other chemically pretty quickly in an atmosphere.
Ah, so they're like the candle and the ice.
Precisely. Finding them both together strongly suggests some massive ongoing biological source is constantly pumping both out, fighting that natural destruction. That would be huge.
Okay, that makes sense. So let's try and pull together some of the key themes that run through Catling's work. The first one seems to be that life is fundamentally a planetary phenomenon.
Yeah, that's central. Life isn't just passively sitting on a planet, it's an active part of the planetary system. It drives change.
Like the Great Oxidation Event.
Exactly. So the takeaway is, if life exists, it should leave a planetary scale fingerprint. Whether it's changing the whole atmosphere or creating that O2 methane signature, you look for planets that seem biologically altered.
Okay, theme one. Life changes planets. What's another big one? Maybe that tension between ubiquity and contingency.
Ooh, yeah, that's a deep one. The ingredients, the stardust, seem to be everywhere, ubiquitous. But
Right.
Catling really makes you grapple with the possibility that the specific steps needed to get life started, a biogenesis, or especially to get complex, intelligent life, that might be incredibly rare, like a wild statistical fluke.
That ties into the Fermi paradox, doesn't it?
Yeah.
If life's ingredients are common, where is everybody?
Exactly. Catling suggests maybe there's a great filter, some massive hurdle that most life just doesn't overcome. Maybe starting life is the filter. Or maybe, more chillingly, the filter's still ahead of us, like civilizations tend to destroy themselves before they go interstellar.
Sobering thought. Okay, a third theme. What about the resilience of life? Extremophile.
Yes. Studying life that thrives in absolute bonkers conditions, boiling acid deep inside rocks near volcanic vents.
Places we used to think were totally sterile.
Totally. Finding life there dramatically expands the real estate available for life in the universe, as Catling puts it. It forces us to ditch our Earth-centric biases about where life could exist. Maybe life out there uses totally different chemistry and environments alien to us. Keep an open mind.
Yeah, that's crucial. And Catling's writing, it's full of these really punchy, almost philosophical lines that capture the weight of it all.
Oh, definitely. One of my absolute favorites, it just elevates the whole thing, is astrobiology is ultimately the story of cosmic evolution becoming aware of itself.
Wow, that frames our search as like a phase of the universe itself.
Doesn't it? It gives it this incredible significance.
And then there's that line about oxygen we mentioned. The rise of oxygen was the greatest pollution event in Earth's history.
Yeah, such a powerful reminder. One organism's waste is another's catastrophe or opportunity. Shows how disruptive life can be.
And hitting on that Fermi paradox silence again.
Right. He notes that the apparent contradiction, high probability of life, zero evidence of ET, may be telling us something fundamental about the rarity of intelligence or the fate of civilizations. That silence itself might be the most important data point we have.
Okay, this is all fascinating, mind-bending stuff, but how does thinking about astrobiology actually help us, in regular life? It feels pretty out there.
It's surprisingly relevant, actually. First off, that whole coevolution idea, life-changing planets, it gives us a really deep geological context for understanding planetary stewardship today.
How so?
Well, when you see the Great Oxidation Event as a planet-scale biological crisis driven by waste products, suddenly human impact on climate change doesn't seem entirely unprecedented in scale, just maybe in speed. It connects our current challenges directly to deep Earth history.
That's a powerful connection. Cyanobacteria pollution, then arc illusion now.
Okay.
Okay.
What else? It also teaches incredible systems thinking. Astrobiology forces you to connect dots across chemistry, geology, physics, biology, all at once. Learning to think that way, integrating knowledge across fields, that's a super valuable skill for almost any complex problem today.
Makes sense. You can't just stay in your lane.
Not in this field. And finally, it really sharpens your critical thinking skills.
Wow.
By learning about the rigorous evidence-based methods scientists use to look for biosignatures, these faint signals from light years away, you get a really good sense of what constitutes strong evidence for extraordinary claims. It helps you filter science from pseudoscience.
Right. Extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. CatLink shows what that evidence actually looks like.
Exactly.
You know, what really surprised me most digging into this was realizing just how unified the sciences have to be for astrobiology. You can't just be a biologist or an astrophysicist. You need to understand quantum chemistry and stellar evolution just to think about microbes on another planet. It just smashes all the usual academic silos.
It really does. And I think the final really provocative thought CatLink leaves us with is this. The search itself is changing us. It's transforming how we understand life, our own planet, our place in the universe.
Even if we find nothing.
Even if we find nothing.
Yeah.
Because the process of searching, of defining life, of figuring out what makes a planet habitable, that has already forced us to look at ourselves and our world in a fundamentally new cosmic way, the quest itself is profound, regardless of the answer.
A testament to asking the biggest questions.
Absolutely.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker. Another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Ekatra Foundation.